Okay. And sir, what year did you graduate high school?
1966.
Okay. And where do you live?
I live in Liberty Township in Clark County.
Okay. Now, these questions are just a springboard. Mm-hmm. We're trying to find out as much as we can about how ranching has changed in Clark County since like the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And you said before that you came here in 47?
Well, my father and grandfather, they bought the original ranch where I live. It was called the Eastman Ranch at that time. They bought it in 1947 in the fall. I was born in the fall of 1948. So that's...
So your family came from Ford County?
Yes.
Originally?
Yeah. Dad and my grandfather and father, none of them ever moved and lived in Clark County. They lived in Buckland and in Spurville, northeast Ford County, in that area. And then how far back you want to go?
Well, let's stay with your Clark County story,
okay.
If
All
you
right.
don't mind.
Okay.
So you're the first generation that's lived in Clark County?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, on a permanent basis, yes.
Okay. Has your family always ranched or run cattle?
Yes.
Did you farm on the side?
Yes.
Okay. What types of crops did you raise?
Well, mostly, we're talking for Clark County. Okay, well, in Clark County, we've raised alfalfa, wheat, corn, soybeans, and milo. I guess we've had milo for a while.
Are you raising to farm or are you raising to feed animals?
Feed animals, mostly.
Okay. What kind of, what breed of cattle do you usually run?
We run they bought our original cow herd in 1952, this Hereford cattle out of Colorado. And then starting in, probably the 70s, I began a slow switch over to Angus. And then in late 1980s, we switched strictly to using Angus bulls, and we're strictly Angus at this point.
What prompted the switch?
Our gardeners, basically, when Mark, we'd bought bulls before from Henry off and on, not strictly. And then Mark, when the EPDs come out and stuff after he got out of college, he sat down and we tried a lot of different cattle on heifers. You know, we did Longhorns, Jerseys. Anything for calving ease, and the EPDs, we visited with him extensively on that, and we decided we would try it. And after about 2 years of that, we were pretty well sold on the EPDs and the way to do that. So we began to switch strictly to Angus. All the other breeds failed to recognize it as quick as the Angus breed did. So they were a good 10 to 15 years behind them before they all kind of woke up and began to look at EPDs and such things.
Tell us what EPD means.
Expected progeny difference. It's a system I can't probably really totally explain. You better ask Mark. Basically it allows you through information provided by breeders and commercial and seed stock breeders both to be put in a database, which gives you an idea of, this is just a rough deal of it, that the probability of calving ease, different traits in an animal, this has been expanded from what it originally started for me. But of course our main goal then was the calving ease, and it certainly worked there. And it continues to, we've expanded different things we look at now, but it's...
What do you look for now?
Mainly you look for carcass, a lot of carcass data. You're trying to provide an animal that will great eating experience. I don't know if you, going back to when I got out of college in 1970, the per capita consumption of beef in the U.S. began a steady decline from the late 60s all the way to about the mid-90s, actually late 90s. We're losing
market.
And they come out, well, they had tenderness tests. They had all kinds of tests about animals for an eating experience, because a person would go to a restaurant and he'd have a good eating experience, then he'd have a poor eating experience. So there's no consistency. The hog and chicken people began all this even ahead of the cattle. So we kept losing market share there, which at that time was mostly domestic U.S. type market. And then we, so that went on. We kept, there was, it would take a full afternoon to go through all that with you, but the, anyway, that's what the EPDs did. It allowed you to give a consistent product that could be proven. And when they had when they began to come back carcass data in the mid-90s, then I think that's when the group of ranchers formed U.S. Premium Beef. And Mark was on that. My brother, he was on that original deal too, and original board. And that's what they're trying to do, is find a market that they could do. By this time, we're into exports, and National Beef, who is the fourth largest nation or beef packer in the U.S. at that time, still they're the fourth largest, but they're compared to their kill to the two largest, it's like nothing. So they were always fighting for position, you know, because they had to combat. They had to bid against those people and develop their own markets. That's all right.
I am sorry. That's one of the, yeah. Sir, you were talking about why you had changed to Angus, because you wanted to have a more marketable product and you wanted to have a consistent product, correct?
Right.
And you were worried about being able to sell in America as well as exporting outside.
Right. Well, we were losing market share until then, and then fairly rapidly. And then within a few years after U.S. Premium Beef started, it forced, basically, they had for a while, not a corner, but they had access to reliable cattle, especially for export or for high-end restaurant-type trade. So what that did was forced all the packers to come out with programs, if you can furnish us cattle. Now, there was program cattle clear back into the 1960s. I went to school at TCU through a program, and we toured through a good part of Texas, Kansas, and Oklahoma, and there were what they, back in those days, they called them sweetheart deals, where different large packers, they would furnish a commodity set of cattle of an area. Back then, they used, they knew that if a certain set of cattle come out of this area, that on average, this is what would happen. And if you had enough volume of those cattle, you could make a little better deal with a packer to furnish these cattle on a consistent basis. But they still varied, and so then you had the, but this here is what we went, is we knew the industry then at the time, you have to produce from the 1960s up until then, everybody was after, we got to get our product cheaper, cheaper, cheaper to compete with it. And then somewhere the light bulb come on a set of people that, you know, well, we got, let's produce a superior product that we can get more money for, something somebody wants to eat. And that's where the switch began to come in. And now we're on this. We're not trying to compete on a cheap basis necessarily with pork and chicken. We're giving you an eating experience, and you get things out of beef that you can't get elsewhere in other meats. And so that's where we are. And through the EPDs, with everything coming out now, all the genetic genome testing and stuff that they have now you just constantly can make it better, just a lot more rapidly than you could before. By the time you knew you had a bull that could produce in the old days, he was dead. Mm-hmm. By the time you had enough progeny off of him to really figure what was going on, or he was really old. Mm-hmm. So breeders back then, they would, if they were going to hold semen off of him to produce, they may, I don't know, I can't know the percentage because we can't do that, but I would say, they would have a lot of semen drawn off a lot of critters, and then some of them just proved nothing. Yeah, so you just out that money. So this allows a lot better deal what you do.
That's less the difference. Of a gamble. It's less of a gamble.
Yeah, you had commodity cattle all up until then. See, the Hereford breed, going clear back, my family come in here trading Texas cattle in the 1870s, not in Clark County, but in Pawnee County. Mm-hmm. And they were based out of Illinois, and they had a commission house in Kansas City, and they come out of Illinois, so they went in there and then sold these cattle out. These are longhorn cattle. That's what my great-grandfather did. He traded. They sent him, his dad and brother sent him out here to trade these cattle, and then that's what he did. And then after the blizzard of 1886, then I've still got the letter. He wrote a letter back to his brother and dad. They were all partnered in. They were buying cattle or land in Nebraska. There, they, I don't know what their Duma Vista later years, but anyway, he wrote back and he said, we cannot no longer operate the way we've been. We've had all these open winters, and this year has proved that, it's not, we got to change our ways. And because he had a family story, and this is, again, family story, but he had like 3,000 steers overwintering up in Pawnee County, and he lost every one of them. Okay. So then he said, I need blooded cattle. So he went into a registered Galloway business, and we still got a lot of those papers he had from the 1890s, early 1900s on that. But anyway, so they changed what they did because what was going wasn't working. So he saw the idea of better cattle. So for years, people improved the longhorn cattle through Galloway, Angus, Hereford crossing. Well, the Hereford breed at that time, most of the breeds back then, even the Angus and Hereford, those were huge cattle, and they could travel and stuff. Then somewhere in the 1930s, somebody came up with this idea, we want an animal that's all meat and no bone, The old Ace Reed cartoons are the guy with a pry bar trying to lift him off a little pebble of rock because he's high-centered. So you had that, and that's what you had through the 30s, 40s, early 50s. And then by the 60s, when I've become more knowledgeable than you, you looked at... then you begin to search for things. We went through the exotic crosses, the Simmental, the blah, 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 and all down the line, Guelphy. We tried it all, and every one of them had its traits, but you could never get away from the calving difficulties. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's at that time, Angus cattle, when we first started, were not real big cattle. They were small also because every breed went that way. And but they had, because of their pelvic tilt, they were easier calving cattle. We used to do pelvic measuring and tilt and all that. And when we selected heifers, well, then you move on as you learn or whatever. But now this is it's becoming much, much easier to do. But back then, in the early feeding days of the 60s and 70s, you were killing... you were killing cattle out of the feed yard at 1,000 to 1,100 pounds. 1,200 pounds, a big animal out of the feed yard back then. And he was probably 20, A young one would be 20, 22 months of age, almost 2 years old by the time he killed that way. And now our program is at this time, and we're still looking, is we start killing our cattle at 13 months of age all the way up to about 16 months of age. Those cattle weighed 1,000 to 1,100 pounds, 1,200, a big one, in those early days. And now these are killing out at that age at 1,400, 1,500 pounds. So this is the improvement made over that period of time. And I don't know where the end in sight is on it. But so
it took 50 years to improve the breeding that much?
Well, it took, I guess, cattle people are the deal. Well, the other thing that a lot of people don't understand is I grew up on the tail end of shipping cattle by train, blah, blah, and all that stuff. And through the 50s, we used to run a lot of country in the Flint Hills, and they'd ship out of there cattle way, and that was back when you still had somewhat bigger animals. See, there's two deals. The animals that won all the shows were the little squatty thing, but people that knew what cattle were about did not have those cattle.
My daddy always lost the show ring and he won carcass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get into this, and that was the big fight when I was in college, is, well, how come all these cattle that do the show looking are pretty lousy cattle? Mm-hmm. And that, but it was all, but anyway, that's the deal. So you over time, you've taken now for what he's truly worth, but you had all this different directions everybody was going. When I was there, we bought, when I was young, in the 1930s, early 40s, my grandfather, he worked for Swift and Henry out of Kansas City. And
who were Swift and Henry?
They were a big packer commission firm. They bought fat cattle, all ranges of cattle, calves and stuff. They had a commission firm. His country that he covered was eastern Colorado, northeast New Mexico, maybe a little bit of western Oklahoma, but that's where he traded for them. And they would go out there, like at Lahaina a lot, and there's a town of Thatcher to the west of Lahaina, and they would, it had a big Santa Fe yards in it, and the guys would drive cattle in at that time. Still in the inner 30s, you still had your trail drives out of northeast New Mexico and Colorado. Mm-hmm. They'd drive in there, the buyers would come out, and they'd go look at the cattle trade. Then you had to order your cars. So then you ordered your cars. When your cars come in, then the cattle come in, you sorted them, you loaded them. Then you hauled them to Kansas City. It was your job to set them up and show them and sell them. Then you go right back out. Mm-hmm. My dad said there was times in he would see his dad for maybe 60 days because all he did was train back and forth. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, that's the way that all went back then. They traded a lot of cattle. So when he began to break out on his own after the 30s, then he had tons and tons of contacts out there and bought a lot of cattle straight. And we were steer operators mostly back in those days. We really didn't switch clear over to cows till probably 1990s. More cows, and we still run a lot of steers back through till 2000, I suppose, and then we went mostly to a just cow deal.
Why?
Because of the steer deal back then was still a margin business, but from what we learned from early on there through 2000 is we still bought steers, but we're very selective on what we bought. More selective. We used to be pretty slick. We only buy western calves and northern calves, like out in Nebraska. We pastured in, we've run country from Nebraska, Colorado, never been Wyoming, and just a little bit in Texas, some in Oklahoma, but mostly Colorado.
Why?
Nebraska, and the Flint Hills.
Why did you like northern cattle?
The southern cattle, you had a lot more sickness on them. Our theory was that if you bought the better animal, you'd pay a little more. But right from the start, due to sickness, health, and all that, and gainability, even out in the country, we had a $35, $36 advantage over southern cattle.
Mm-hmm.
So you could buy Southern cattle cheap, but if you hit a bad deal, you could lose a bunch of them. Yeah. 5-6% death loss. Plus, you did a lot of doctoring, and you would, everybody had, back in those days, had your Bloody Mary mix, which is another thing that we've got rid of is all the antibiotics. But they were cheap, and that's just the way it worked. But everybody wanted rid of that because that was part of our problem. People break a needle off an animal, or they would stab them in the wrong place and cause a bruise, and there's a lot of trim. So as people begin to, a lot of them say, well, that's their problem. But what people finally realize, I'm selling not to the packer, I'm selling beyond him. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are now. And that's why everything's so much better now than it was in that regard. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of why it went all that way, and or as I see it, I guess. But when I was a kid, we just, like I told the guy the other day, you know, when I started grade school, my grandfather, he still traveled a lot buying cattle. He'd make a circle. If my grandmother could go, I was maybe in fifth, sixth grade, he'd just come up and get me, and we'd pull out on a Thursday or Friday and then make a swing on cattle buying. So I got to ride along, and then you hear all the stories that they and all the guys they traded with did. And people we used to pasture with, and he'd set his deals up in the Flint Hills in the late 1930s. And we worked with those same people for three generations. Mm-hmm. And this generation back there now, they're running kind of mostly their own deal, but we sent cattle with them on a grazing deal. Mm-hmm. And I know back in World War II, my dad had just got married, and they went back there, and old Tom, he was kind of crippled up, he's an older gentleman, and they set their deal up for the summer, and he said, well, we can do it. We said, I don't need any cowboys, everybody's got drafted. He said, we don't have anybody do it. So my dad and mother then, they would go back once a month and ride the cattle. They'd stay in his bunkhouse and ride cattle, their own cattle back there on the deal.
Okay.
Because that's just what you had to do back then. And but he was, because all the guys had been drafted at that point. And they did that, I think, 2 years.
Okay.
But that's some stories, and let's see, what else you want to know?
Everything. Would you describe your land? What percentage is farm ground? Do you have deep canyon? Do you have a lot of trees?
We're along the northern part of Bluff Creek, and it's fairly, the west side is really rugged, and that's the Young Brothers Ranch, which Nancy, her family has. We've leased that since 1991 or two. Mm-hmm. And then our ranch borders them on the east side, mm-hmm. their east side. And they bought the Eastman Ranch first in 47. And then in 52, they bought part of what was called the Potter Ranch, north of that. And then through my dad's lifetime, we now own the whole Potter Ranch. He said, my goal in life is to put that back together. Mm-hmm. So he did. And then we own now what was the Dignan Ranch, the original Dignan Ranch up there in Clark County. We bought that in the late 1980s. Mm-hmm. And through the years, what Dad put together used to be about five different ranches. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing from back in the day, what would support a family back through there in the 70s and by the 80s, a lot of that, you couldn't do it. So a lot of that land, people moved out. And of course, in the case of the Dignan family, those gentlemen, they all got older, and it finally just went down to a generation that didn't want to do it. And then the Eastman Ranch, I'm not sure. They bought it originally from the old there was a Drake Ranch. A Drake Ranch in northeast Clark County. It was east of us. He was an Englishman, and this is back, now we're talking back in the 1800s. And anyway, he owned this ranch, and then he run the country from there all the way to the Arkansas River north of Buckland. That's the country used. And one reason we know a lot about the history of that is there's an older guy. He went to work for him in, I think he said, in 1900. He's dead now, but he his job was to keep dig windmills, build towers, and put them up. And he lived on that ranch for 5 years right where I live. Well, from that, he learned the whale trade, and he moved to Spearville. And that's what he did for the good part of his life was work on windmills. So, and then he and Dad had been friends, and then he went to farm a little for us when he got older and couldn't do whales. But I know on the one deal, he and Dad, they dug a well there and built the wood tower and put it up there. And that had been in probably the 1950s sometime.
Was it there till the fire?
No, it came apart once. Dad rebuilt it once, the wood part, and then finally we put a steel tower on it.
Okay.
I would imagine it's...
Okay.
Just weather alert. Tell me it's going to storm. But...
I want to believe them.
Yeah. But that's kind of... from back in there, and like one of the deals in just handling cattle from even when I was a kid in the 50s, early 60s, you had two ways when you gather cattle. That's you ride out real early and then ride back. You were always horseback. And then the only other way, if we were up in Ford County, had to come back, we just used a grain truck with stock racks on it, and you'd load horses and back in the ditch, and then we up there on wheat, we run cattle on wheat for years all the way into Holly, Colorado. So we had some pretty big routes at times. Of course, we didn't drive out to Holly every day, but we farmed out west of Dodge in Ford County. But anyway, we just used a pickup with stock racks on and jump in the back of the pickup. And that's how I was telling my wife the other day because we had the old frame of that thing for years, but the first trailer we bought, I remember it was a hail trailer, $750, and I thought we were going to go broke, according to my dad and granddad, by buying something that damn expensive. Yeah. That was in 1970-something. And other than that, why you rode it or you jumped in the back pickup.
You didn't mind having to take the stock rats in and out of the pickup either, though.
Well, we had one pickup that was just pretty much permanent.
Left them in.
We just left them in. Dad had a deal we could add in the winter. It was a hood that fit up over the cab to keep, and we had goggles for horses. They would fit over the eyes, and then you'd goggle them so the wind and stuff wouldn't hit an eye.
Okay.
And I still had that piece till the fire, and then we kind of burned up.
Things change.
Yep. And let's see, that's... but that's it. And then the other big thing, the change on back then, you fed bundle feed, which I suppose you know what that is.
Do you got a hand bundle?
Well, it's a binder. The old binders, they were, I think, a 9-foot swath is what they took. And you went around, it was for, originally they were developed to bind corn, calf corn, and shock them. You'd have a bundle weighed from, say, 8 pounds to 15 pounds. And then you would shock and feed in the fall with a deer. You'd get two or three of them, drag them, and you'd stick them into a shock of about 30 to 35 bundles.
And a lot of hand labor.
Lots of hand labor. And then, but you could throw 150 of them on a pickup. You know, and our old deal was you, in the winter, when it got cold, you fed a half a bundle a day. And then if it got covered up, you'd feed two bundles a day. If you stayed covered up, you'd go to one bundle a day. If you fed up, that was two bundles. After that, they had to get along on their own. And that was kind of the deal. So,
okay.
That's
when did you go to baling?
Oh, probably not till somewhere in the 70s. We shot feed. We were probably some of the last ones to put up bundle feed. And because I'll probably be in the 70, late 60s, early 70s. Because 70, in spring of 71, that's the year of the big blizzard down here, 26, I mentioned. And I just got out of college. I graduated December of 70. And that blizzard was coming in, so they sent me from Ford County, or from Bellefonte down. My granddad lived in Buckland. So they said, go down there. We had another ranch. Excuse me.
Can I go get you
east
some water?
There.
Can I go get you some water?
January.
No.
Farmer ranch.
Down here.
Okay. Back to where you were thinking.
Blizzard, do you want that story? Or
yes, please.
Okay, well, we had the ranch we were on there, where I live now, and then we also leased a ranch east of there in Clark County, or in Kiowa County,
mm-hmm.
And we had a man lived on that ranch, and we only had one four-wheel drive pickup, and he had it over there, but anyway, when the blizzard hit, we were in town there, and it blew 3 days and 26, 7 inches, whoever you want to talk to. But all our deep canyons, it just, it was level full. So granted, our phones weren't out, but electricity was out, at least in the country. And then, so at that time, CCAP Feed Yard was operating Bob CCAP, and he bought a lot of his grain from Buckland Grain. And the man at Buck and Grain, he come down and he asked, we tried to get out of time too, we could only move north and south, but on the highway, so we were trying to find a way down there because we didn't have four-wheel drive. So anyway, Bill Mattson is his name, he come down to my grandfather, he said, well, if Roger will go with us and guide us in down the ridges, because we can't get down there. We got to go down off the top of the blowing ridges. He said, then I'll get him down there to your cattle. So we started out. There's four of us in an old Jeep, Willie Jeep, and carried four scoop shovels. If you get stuck, you just dug out. And we went down the one ridge. There's kind of a long ridge. It'll run almost clear to Sea Cats if you know how to zigzag on a little bit, man. So anyway, I had him take me to our south end, what we call the Twin A Sheds now. They weren't there then, but we had an old W9 International tractor there and a big old four-wheel hay trailer, and that's where our hay was. So our plan was to get me into there, which is about 3 miles north of the CCAP feed yard, and then I'd get that tractor load of hay, start up through feeding. And so anyway, we got us down in there, and we had to come off the ridge down into the bottom along the creek, and the tractor was there, had snow drift over it, and started right up. I still got that tractor. And so I said, yeah, I'm good. So I went and hooked on the trailer, and he started up, and it took him a while. It's about a mile back up to the ridge, so but I started up through there, and all of a sudden it just pegged out hot. And I thought, oh guys, somebody didn't put antifreeze in it. And because I'd been in college all that time, and I thought, you know, I froze up the deal. So anyway, I'm 4 miles south of the house. And so I'd had to walk all the way. And so anyway, Bill, they got up top of the ridge, and he said, I thought, you know, I better look back one more time. And boy, I was waving like that. So they come back down. Well, we went back. He took me back north then to above the house. And I said, well, I'll walk in because you couldn't get his Jeep down in there. I walked down in. Well, the old house down there, we had it. At that time, we locked it. But the wind that blew the key off down in the snow. And finally, But I did finally find it, got in. So our telephones still worked. And that house, we didn't have electricity, but we had a warm morning heater. That's what he, just a four-room house. So I still got the house, too. It survived the fire. But the anyway, so I called on the phone in Buckland. So Granddad, he called a mechanic that we used there in town. Said, I told him, or described it. He says, well, it sounds to me like you're out of water. You're like somebody drained the whole system out, so it's like there's no water in it. Because the fan belt wasn't stuck or anything. He said, if it's still running, he said, you're just out of water, low on water, whatever. So anyway, I called Bill Rich, who lived over on the Degman Ranch at that time, and asked him if he could get me some water over there. So I didn't have any vehicles, so I saddled a horse and rode back down to Driscoll. I went our normal way, which would have been out of the wind, but it was busted. The horse starting out, he was just chest high. The snow, it was too hard, so turned around, went up, got on top, horse blew off, and then zigzagged my way down. And Bill, he met him over, see, this four cell phone stuff, so he had a 4020 John Deere tractor, and he started to come in off that other road, but he finally got it so deep on that he couldn't push anymore with it. So then about the last, half a mile, we carried 2 5-gallon buckets. He helped me. We carried it into where the tractor was and then put it in. And so it was getting long toward dusk then, and so he got back home and he said, you gonna be all right? I said, yeah. So that old tractor, I tied the horse on behind, loaded hay, started back for the house. Well, again, the normal trails, you're packed, so you had to do it. So I had fence flyers, and so I just began to cut fences and stay on the ridges to get back up there. And I always remember that, I don't know why I did it, but I saddled a colt because I just thought, well, if I got to kill something in the snow, I'll do that. And so anyway, wasn't really a bright move, but wasn't that old. And so anyway, got back to horse. He never did lead good, but he did after that. And but anyway, so I got back up there. Well, that night, you couldn't let it run all night. We had gravity flow gas for its gas engine. So every night, then I had to get 2 5-gallon buckets, drain all the water out of the radiator in the block, and then take it in the house and set it to do it. And so every morning you pour it back in, go down, load cattle hay. And I had one set of cattle over clear west where it's really rough. We couldn't get to for about 2 or 3 days. When it began to break open, then what I would do was on those, if I got time, then I would take one saddle horse. I didn't have a pack saddle, but I'd load 3 sacks of cake on one horse, and then you'd have to ride about 3 or 4 miles to get two, you know, and to get over to them. And then they had running water, and they could come up on top, and then you cake them. Well, then we had a guy from Oklahoma that had come pheasant hunting or quail hunting up here, and he was an Air National Guard pilot. So he called up and said, you can't see the border. We're not supposed to cross the line. But he said, I know about where you are. If you'll spot me where to do it, I will
drop hay
in the small square bale. So anyway, I went there. We allotted the time when he would be there, and I rode over there. Well, he dropped the hay all right, but it dropped out in most of it dropped in between the hills. They're just like this.
Yeah.
And so the cattle couldn't get to them. So then I carried 2 throw ropes, mm-hmm. and then I'd set the horse on the side and then go about 2 bales at a time and then dally up and then drag them back. Pull them back up. But always by the time you got them cut and went and got the next two, they're pretty well ate up. But did that for 3 days, and then Bill was able to finally get up from his place, and he got to hold him. He had silage, so he'd hold them cows silage till we get to them. But But that's what I did. And I tell my daughters when they were young the story, and they said, "What'd you eat?" And I said, "Well, my granddad, he loved sardines. Sardines and mustard, he's awesome. He thought for some reason they was going to quit making them. He bought like 3 cases of sardines and mustard sauce, that and pork and beans for about a week."
Cold.
Yeah. And well, actually, I could cook. I had, I think, a pound or so of bacon, and there's a dozen eggs there, so I could cook breakfast, but you had to cook it on that one morning heater. Mm-hmm. And
Do you know what your losses were?
Not really that bad. We had a set of cattle that we had on wheat. There was only like 25 of them, but they had packed down a spot, and they just stayed in that circle. And it was probably 5 days by the time we got to them, and we couldn't drive them out of that circle. They just would not leave it. So we even took a tractor and backed a track into it and tried to get them out that track. And finally, we were able to push them out behind that. We got them north there to some water, to the tank, and they all drank. But those cattle, they never did well after that. They didn't die, but they just it kind of messed them up.
They'd been stressed.
And I thought we'd lose a lot of baby kids, but we really didn't. Mm-hmm. Not as many as we did in 79. But mm-hmm. When we had 2 foot snow on the level for about 45 days, and it just snowed and settled, didn't blow, so cattle couldn't get to any grass. You had to feed them everything they did. We took front end loader, trying to push it off, and calves, even old cows would have calves melt down into the ground, and then they couldn't get them up. So every night we had an old trailer house there by then, and we would on those cattle, then we'd bring as many baby calves at dark in as we could, warm them up, put milk down, and then take them back out and try to pair them up the next morning. And I know we had that one on farm truck, and I think the ones we picked up dead, that we had 48 dead calves on that pickup at the end of the snow. And but you take that and you push it down so the calves had a place to lay. We'd bed it down with old hay, but the cows ate everything you'd ever lay out. And they'd be laying down nice, and the calf be standing out in the snow. A lot of frozen feet, frozen ears. And it was a nasty winter. But anyway, that's. But that was the second time that old tractor saved me, because Kathy was pregnant with Jenny then, and we were down doing deal, and I saw a cow out there. She was laying. I thought she'd had the calf, and I went off into a sandbar and got stuck. And so we had 2 ways at that time, and then we were trying to get all the sea cats, because we were just east of them or west of them, and couldn't get them. So I said, well, I could get along before dark, and so I told Kathy, I said, well, I got to walk. It's 2 miles up to where that tractor was parked, but it's along a creek, so it's blowing snow and stuff. But I walked up to there, got the old tractor started again, got down there. By the time I got there, she'd got a hold of Bobby, and they sent a crew over, and they pulled her out already. But so that was being stupid. It's better the calf die than your wife and baby. Mm-hmm. So that's the story. The things I kind of remember, and those deals. But every family's got those stories, like I say, back in the 40s were the real pickup years for agriculture, and the 30s were tough. My grandfather, he farmed Ford County. He also farmed a section around Finney County, north of Garden. Mm-hmm. And he said, he told me in 30. Like 31 or 2 is the last wheat crop he ever got off that place. It was rented ground. And but he said he had a real good crop. But back then, they didn't have many elevators. So when you sold your grain, then you ordered in a car. And then you loaded on a wagon, or like you had a 1-ton truck. But you scooped it off. It was all piled on the ground. So you'd scoop it on there and back up to the car, you'd scoop it into the car, and then you'd scoop it to the back side of the car three to four times. He said, I did that for 25 cents a bushel. And he said then all of his equipment, then in the 30s it started blowing and it covered it up. He says, I dug it out twice and I finally give up. So that's the story of the 30s. That's not Clark County, but I do have one story about Clark County. It's on land we have now, but a guy that was there then in the 30s, I always ask him on that because he lived on the ranch right next to it. And he and his wife, he was newly married, but he said in the 30s, this one pasture, we call it the Potter pasture. That's the first one we bought on that Potter end. But on the east side of it, there was all these big gouge outs in the land, you know, like somebody come in and planted or blew. He said, well, actually, it was never farmed. It blew because the grass was gone. And he said what they had done, the grass all died out. Well, then the cactus, he said that pasture was just solid cactus. So the government, in their wisdom at that time, paid him so much a load to cut the cactus out, throw it in a wagon, and then pile it and burn it.
By hand?
Huh?
By hand?
Shovel.
Okay.
You chop it off. And their idea was that then the grass could come. But he said one thing he learned from watching that was that there was always a little grass around that cactus that cattle couldn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And he said as soon as he chopped that cactus out of there, then it was gone. And he said that's when it started blowing. And he said he always thought they were wrong, but he said that back through you did, that's what you're paid to do.
Yeah.
And my granddad, he said back in there, they had those deals where they'd buy your cattle, and then you dig a hole, shoot them, and push them in.
Did your grandfather have to shoot?
He did some, not too bad. I always remember it. There at Belfont, one on the elevator, and one young guy, he's older than me, but he's come in whining about the price of cattle and how he's going to do it. And my grandson said, are you broke? And he said, well, no. He says, if you haven't been broke at least twice, he says, you're not working. he went broke when he was about 25. He'd been broke a couple of times. He said, if you're not doing that, then you're not trying hard enough.
The trick is not staying broke.
Yeah, he said, there's nothing wrong. He told me the first time he went broke in World War I was, he said he was up there and his brother and him raised the ranch in Ness County. And his brother got called into service. So it left him there and he got married while he was up there and had a baby. But he broke sod to make eating money. For people at that time with a team, you know, it'd take $2 an acre, take him all winter break, a half section out. And he took in cattle and horses for Grumbine's, lived up in there. There's big ranches up there. He said he didn't have money to buy cattle. They come out in World War II and the bank there, and they told him, well, if you buy the cattle, you know, we need beef for the war. And he said, well, I haven't got any money. I got no collateral. And he said, well, we'll loan you 100%. And so he
at
said.
At what interest?
I don't know what. I think it was only 3 or 4%, something like that. Wasn't bad, but he said, so he bought the cattle. But back then, you buy calves, then run them 2 years, and then you sell them. All the time he sold them, the war was over. The deal, while he was there, they got the scabies, so he had to build a dipping vat, and he dipped cattle, and that horse deal, they'd take in horses for the winter, and then in the spring, they'd help that ranch, his cowboy, they'd start some horses for him, long story short, he went broke. He said, I had a used saddle I bought in 1915, and still got that, 15. He bought it used, and when he went out there, and then when I got done, I had a wife, a baby, a Model A or Model T Ford, and two saddle horses in my saddle. He said they let me keep the wife and baby in my saddle and took everything else. But he said they did his brother-in-law had this place in Ford County, and he was a lawyer in Fort Worth, and he told him to, he said, well, the man I've got on there on the place farming, he's bought his own land, and he's moving off. So I got all the equipment, so you come down here, we'll start you out again. So he moved down there and got started out again.
Still had his saddle.
Yeah, still had his saddle and his wife and baby. Okay. He said the only pleasure he got out was the banker let him drive the car down to get there. Banker rode with him, and then he said halfway back, he knocked the rods out of the car, and he had to walk 10 miles to get out. He said he found that out later.
No good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, but those are side stories. They're not about Clark County. I'm sorry.
No, it's cool. Did you have to hire outside help, or were you able to just work family?
We worked at both. I mean, through the years when we, I know Dad, this is back in Fort Worth again, but they worked two or three, four young men, and they had a bunkhouse up there. And they would, my mother cooked three meals a day, did all their laundry and everything. And that's what they did back, this would be back in the 40s, mm-hmm. late 40s, early 50s. And then when we grew our ranch and size grew, we I think one time we had maybe 500-600 men. Now we've got, basically one part-time man now, and three girls, and one son-in-law work. Mm-hmm. But we don't run near the cattle we run back then. About three daughters.
Three girls and a part-time man and yeah. One son-in-law.
Yeah.
So four and a half.
Four and a half, yeah.
And you.
Yeah.
Okay.
What a word.
Okay. In your current farming operation, how much is farming part of what you do now? I know from the fire stories that wheat pasture saved.
Yeah, a lot of, yeah. Well, we, the ranch is, let's see, there's about, 22 or 300 acres of farm ground on it. Mm-hmm. And it's, some of it's irrigated, not a lot, most of it's not what you call a really good farm ground. It's shallow soil, sandy. You can drive 100 feet and hit three soil types. It's not a crop raising deal, but it's great for pasture. You can get in early and everything. And we come from what they call summer fall country. Fort County deep soils. You a lot of water holding capacity up here. You do not have that. It's kind of whatever falls is what you live on. But it's great on wheat. You never run into mud problems. And that's so all of our ground is, almost all of it's planted to wheat every fall, wheat or triticale, and then grazed out. Mm-hmm. Usually grazed out half of it at least, and then we'll cut some. But
Do you catch your own wheat?
Grain is a byproduct for us, probably.
Okay. Do you circle irrigate?
Yes.
And do you cut your own wheat? Do you hire it cut?
No, we hire it cut. We quit in 86 or 8. Quit cutting ours out.
Okay. You were saying several things about how you think ranching has changed in the last 100 years. The fact that now you have a horse trailer instead of stock racks. Other things. Do you use four-wheelers?
Not for cattle, other than checking when we're calving. We don't handle cattle with four-wheelers anymore.
What major changes do you think have come along?
Pardon?
What major changes in cattle handling do you think have come along?
Well, the for us, I don't look at it as much change. My grandfather, the way I was brought up, and Dad, it was let cattle do what you want them to rather than make them. That was their philosophy. You let cattle do, you show them the way. Now, we're probably a little gentler now than we used to be, but part of the deal back then, too, was wild cattle. especially off the western ranches. When I was, I'd been in 62 or so, somewhere in there, 62, 63. I was probably about 15 or 16. They bought a bunch of cattle out of New Mexico and Albuquerque off the desert. Well, they took one end of them. We leased country in eastern Colorado. And that was the last major. They sent them by rail. They still had rail service into where we were going by train. The lot came up here was by truck. And so anyway, they called down and Dad said, well, I'm sending these cattle up here. We could get, these are the little 38, 40 foot pots back then. And we could still get in there where I live. And he said, well, you take them there and unload them and then I'll be home the next day and we'll work, I'll start working on them. And anyway, rain, couldn't get in there, but we had we could get to the north end of the ranch. And I said, well, rain, I don't think I can get them trucks in there. And he said, just portable load and shoot. He said, just put it against the fence on, we had a trap, a 200 acre trap there. And he said, well, just jump them out in there. They're all carrying this guy's brand down here. And we'll get them out the next morning. Well, I dumped, I think, 300 or 400 out in there. Next morning, I had 3 left in it. They didn't know what a fence was. And I should have known because when my grandfather went down to look at him, I went with him. And this little boy, his shipping trap was 4,000 acres. And he went out on this hill and couldn't see any cattle. And we were sitting there and he said, well, the boys will bring him by in a minute. And here they come by, 3 riders, and they come back, they dead run in the dirt. And he says, you want to look at them again? I'll have them turn them around, you know. And so anyway, he traded a lot of cattle. He was very good. He says, no, I've seen what I wanted to see. And they made a trade. But anyway, then they had to go back to get them and line up. That's how that all come about. But anyway, on this deal, when they finally made a trade, they sent, these are calves. Mm-hmm. They sent, this is off that big desert country, and they have cattle that they missed over the time.
Right.
So we got some that were probably 3 to 4 year olds. Yes. He threw in for nothing.
How kind of him.
Uh-huh. That was a big mistake. And that's when you quit, don't take free cattle. There's a problem here. And so anyway, they had horns like that, and they were basically wild animals. And so anyway, when we went together, and we finally on those cattle, we tried to, a lot of them mixed with our own cows, so we tried to bring them in. We got some that way, some this way, but there was about 6 or 8 of these really wild cattle. Even the calves were young. They would go out, and you'd try to gather, and they would run away from you. And if they saw a big clump of weeds or tall grass, they would lay down like a coyote and try to hide. And when they get up, we finally started carrying 2-3 ropes. We timed the tree. We had trailers come along behind, pick up stuff to load them in. Mm-hmm. And you rope them and then time the tree. Well, some of them, they would just, as soon as the rope set on, they just hit the brakes and they'd come right at you. And you'd have to trip them. I don't know if you've ever done that or seen that done. But it's, and some of that one, I know I had to lay him out like 3 times before he'd stay down. And you just throw him in the air and knock the air out of him is what you do. It's not a thing they probably want you to do today. But anyway, these were wild cattle, but I know we had one old steer that was really big, and we never could catch him. He just would pace you. He kind of stayed in this 1-2-3 section area. Mm-hmm. But if you go after him, if you'd speed up, he'd speed up, he'd slow down. And he just, he had stamina and stuff. And finally, he got located up by my house in a really steep canyon deal with some brush in it. And Dad said, well, I'm going to get him. And he had a really fast horse. And so he said, you swing down below. And he said, I've got it figured out. If you crash up through that brush and make noise, he said, he's going to come out about right here, and I'm going to catch him. And anyway, so I did that, and I thought, this got to be good. And so anyway, I could hear that old steer just crashing through the brush. And like he had horns, he couldn't go fast through there.
Right.
That's what Dad's counting on. Well, I got offside where I could see what was going to happen. Anyway, the steer come out right where Dad said he would, but right ahead of him was a bobcat that went under Dad's horse and squealed. And Dad's horse went to buck and he lost his rope. He never did catch him. But anyway, that's so that steer got away. So the steer, all summer long, we tried to catch him, never could. And he was telling guys over Dodge one day about him. They said, I will send some guys down that can catch him. So they come down, and two guys, and they basically two-timed him. They one lope him circle, and then the other come in, lope him circle. They got him wore down where they could get up on him a little bit. Hit him twice with a tranquilizer gun, and he began to slow more. So this one guy thought, well, I can get him now. So he roped him, and again, he roped around the horn. Same deal as those little cattle. As soon as that rope settled on his head, that old steer just stopped and turned around, took out into the horse. And he just, he was running up the hill, but his old steer was just butting the horse in the butt. He was yelling, help, help, help. And they finally got another deal on him, and we got him tied down in a trailer. And they had the Hale trailers back then. Like I say, we were the last one to get. But anyway, they tied him down, hauled him to Dodge's winners, and they put him in the old Santa Fe yards, which are huge. I mean, real heavy timber. And that steer would set in the middle of the pan. Anybody walked by, he just hit that thing as hard as he could, just splinter stuff, and finally, Winters, they called, or Jack called Dad and said, he said, I'm not letting him out of there. He said, all right, nothing will hold him. So he said, we're going to put him down right there. And so we got to hold the Jones back, and he said, well, we'll get him. So they just shot him in the pen and then drug him out and butchered him. But I imagine meat wasn't too rippy. But,
he made good hamburger.
Yeah, but it was quite a rodeo. And that, you know, that said, well, that's a good lesson on free cattle. They want to give you something.
Yes.
But anyway, sorry, am I getting too off?
You are getting story? Just, you are just fine.
Okay, and then, with that, going back to, like I say, our family come in the Texas Trail Raid, that come out of Illinois, and they bought Texas cattle, traded them, and they did that, and then they found out, and then they went to what my grandfather at the time, great-grandfather, called blood cattle, which are Galloways, is what the breed he brought. Yeah, he was, one time in the early 1900s, he'd been the largest Galloway breeder in Kansas, but which didn't say a whole lot, but everything.
Okay, I thought Galloways were Scottish,
they
long-haired.
Are, but they had already brought them into Illinois. They look a lot like a long-haired Angus.
Okay.
And we've got a picture he had, and they took in the late 1890s out of the stockyards in Kansas City, and he was selling these cattle. He showed them they had lined up there. They looked just like her Angus cattle.
Okay.
But we had that photo dated. Dad took it. And anyway, they said, well, they couldn't find a date on the photo because they didn't know for sure. And he said, well, what it did, we took it to a guy, a historian on photographs, and he said that back then, photographers, they would put their own shadow of the camera or themselves in there. The shadow would throw all over. And he said they quit doing that in, I think, 1896, 8, somewhere in there. But prior to that, that's what it is. So it had to be doing somewhere in the
So that's how you dated it. Okay.
And so that's how we dated it. It's not an exact date. And we also know that he lived at Burdett, and they had to advertise as Burdett. That's when the rails come through. And the prior to that, it was called Brown's Grove. Mm-hmm. And so when it switched from Brown Grove to Burdett, I'm not sure which year that was, but that's when it does. But anyway, so we had that. Well, then my grandfather, after World War One, then he just got worked for Swift and Henry and farmed there in Ford County, and then and somewhere in the 30s there, then he started buying his own cattle and putting back in the Flint Hills. And that's the way we started. But basically, we were margin operators. We buy calves, you sell them on the margin. Well, that worked pretty good. But he would trade cows, whatever. And but anyway, then in the 40s, in World War II, then there was a terrific demand for beef. So Dad, like Dad said back then, it wasn't a matter of whether you'd make money. It's a matter of can you get them? Because everybody was making a ton of money through the 40s on the cattle. He said it was a matter of just you
getting hold of them.
Getting hold of them, because everybody was after them. So that's what, and I know one time we went up and down the railroad lines there from, well, like he drove in and out of Sitka, back clear back through the early 50s or mid 50s in on rail. You know, they drive from the ranch down there and then loading out. And I don't think he never drove into Ashen. I don't know, I guess Ashen had yards, but there's big stockyards at Sitka. Mm-hmm. And then all the way from, I think Kinsley, all the way to, I think Syracuse, he said I drove cattle in and out of all them railroad pens sometime or other. But I remember as a little kid once in Spearville there, we waited on, we went there for daylight because you never knew when the trains were coming in. So you had to sit there and they would spot the cars for you. Mm-hmm. And then you could unload. And then usually everybody had to operate the brakes, so they'd sit. Sometimes you only had one spot. Most times you had two, you could load and unload time. So then you get some places had a tractor, or sometimes you just used to pick up, took the brake off, and then creep them forward to get unloaded. And we'd just sit there and they'd build a fire, put on a pot of coffee, and then sit wait for the train coming. And then daylight, you'd drive out of there. And that's what I never got in on any of that part. I was too young then. But I'd go along, sit and watch.
That's quite a change to your modern operation, because, I'm sorry, you're working women now. The difference in the, let's say, the physical demands. Mm-hmm. I expect you have a lot better alleys now, and your chute's probably wonderful.
Oh, yeah, a lot better than what we used to have. But as far as working women, though, my mother, when they got married in their 40s, when she, in the 30s there in Ford County, she was born and raised at Wright. Mm-hmm. But her job, which she'd have been, she was born in 23, so she'd been 10, 11 in there. And her job then was, her dad farmed. They farmed and had a little pasture, milk cows, things like that. But her job every day was to herd cattle up and down the road ditches there. That's what she did all day long. So she rode through all that. So I know when they first got married, like say they go down there and ride pasture together, and then she did a lot of riding back then until she got too many kids, because I can always remember her story. We had a neighbor up there in Old Roy. He was pretty much a chauvinist, you know, a woman's place is here, you know, and so he always frowned on her and always made comments to her, you know, about because she was out riding, working alongside Dad, and Dad, they'd run the wheat cattle there, and they were picking the fence up, and they drove the cattle, and then, he's picking up his stock tank, a metal stock tank loaded on the pickup, and so he handed his horse to Mother, and anyway, long story short, when he threw the tank over, it banged like that, and her horse jumped, and I don't know whether her brain wasn't or his tail, but she's holding, but anyway, he bucked her off, and old Roy come over and helped her up. And he said, by God, woman, if you do what you're supposed to, you wouldn't get hurt like this. She said, I never did like that old devil after that. But he said, well, she wouldn't have got hurt if she'd have been in her where she should have been at home, raising kids. So that's a story from back then. But my oldest sister and I, we were, from the day you could move, you were with them all the time. I don't remember. The mother, after you got, there's seven in our family. So after she got so many kids, then it got less and less she could drag along. But she, through feeding cattle, everything, we were always drug along, sorting, whatever. You go sit over there, you know, and you entertain yourself. Because I remember my granddad, that one time when I got a picture of it, but he bought us each a buggy whip. He always rode a buggy whip. And because he did all that sorting. So he just riding whatever, he always had a buggy whip. And so we'd stand there with our buggy whips waiting to do something. You know. But anyway, that's what we did. But back then you just worked. But the attitude back then of most of the people was that, I tell you, one of the best deals to sum up that life is, Jim Arnold, when he got awarded there at Dodge City on that count. I like that. That speech summed up my dad, him, all that era of people that I knew. And he said, I don't know if I made a lot of money, but I had a hell of a lot of fun. They were a generation that liked what they did. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference I see now in young people now coming in. They're more business-oriented, you know. And not that that's bad, but these guys started with nothing and figured it out as they went. But no matter what you did, you enjoyed it, whether you're making money or not making money. I mean, you enjoyed what you did. And like my dad said, they asked him, well, why don't you get a hobby? And he said, what do I want a hobby for? He said, if you like what you do, you're having fun every day. So what do you want with a hobby? And Jim Arnold, that's to me summed up as few words as you can of what that generation.
Their work did. Was a hobby.
Yeah, their life was everything. You know, that's why all these people, and they had stories. They'd make fun of each other. They'd pick on each other. You know, they'd do all kinds of things. But they enjoyed. They just never thought of. And if you went like my granddad, if you went broke, he said, I looked around. At first, I felt bad, but he said, there's older guys that've been in business for years going broke too. So he said, I thought, you know, I'm not. So he just go again. And like George Herman said one time, told Dad, he said, whether I die rich or poor will depend on the price of cattle. And he said, if you owe a bank enough, he says, they can't shut you down.
How much is enough?
I don't know. But old George, but that was George, those guys' philosophy was just that. They, you get into that era of people. They're back through my granddad, through those era of people, it was, they wanted to make something, do something with themselves. And then in my era, then we got into, I think, a little bit of, well, we got all this, we don't want to lose it, you know. And then you begin to make, not bad decisions, but maybe more conservative decisions. And it's not only a business, but it's a lifestyle, life of living. And I don't see, like I say, we had a wild cattle back then. I don't know if my daughters would know what to do with wild cattle. I mean, now they get one little snore and they don't like them. Let's get rid of that one, you know. And all that. If they knock you down, more than once, you just go on, you know. But that's, when you're young too, you do a lot of things you shouldn't do. And there's things you rope or hook onto you wish you wouldn't have. But I survived most of it, so not too much booger up. But.
Okay. I am going to have to pause this. Yeah.